The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Romani Arrowsmith from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Vogue and Rookie Magazine and Believer Magazine. Our theme for today is kind of a long one, so I'm going to say it and then explain it. The theme is making the familiar strange. So all of the readings today are going to be about things that we're all familiar with, but from an outside perspective who makes it seem strange. This first piece is from Rookie Magazine, and it's called Youth Group. Some of us are blessed to have been born with something to believe in, anchored and translated by one's family. Mine attended a small chapel ceremony every Friday night and always had family day on Sunday. I was baptized and raised Catholic by my grandparents, but I grew up watching my father flit from one belief form to the next. He would read books about the Quran instead of the Quran itself. He chatted with Mormon missionaries outside our house, then left their books unopened on the coffee table. All throughout, I spied, and I understood. It is human nature to want to belong, after all, to yearn to be a part of something greater than ourselves. So when I heard that some seniors at my Catholic high school were all hosting a camp, I thought such an experience could also usher this impressionable sophomore into a greater feeling of belonging. Where one or two are gathered in his name, there he is too. The camp described itself as being for young individuals who wanted to be closer to Christ. It started out light, with icebreaker games between talks and sessions, but soon it felt like we were on the verge of something important and life-changing. I felt windswept by the vibrancy of youth before me, by the genuine twinkle in my friends' eyes as they performed a team-choreographed dance, by the ready and warm smiles I'd receive while just walking around the campsite. A gratefulness soared in my heart. Already, I was calling it a community. Before we became legitimate parts of the church body of Christ, it was mandatory to be prayed over by an assigned team leader. I was told to discern which gift of the Holy Spirit I was willing to receive and let into my heart. It was like choosing which birthstone to put into my very first pair of hypoallergenic earrings. I looked through my team leader's notes on our one-to-one talk sessions, and then through my Bible, with the gifts of the Holy Spirit enumerated and highlighted. I chose faith, since I believed I could really use some. Asking for faith, while seated in the middle of our candlelit high school gym, head bowed in adoration and prayer, was monumental. It was the first time I was able to mindfully choose what I wanted to have space for in my heart. The moment spurred an ecstasy of freedom, a feeling that God was placing my life in the palm of my hand and saying, "Here, my child, take it and do whatever you were meant to do with it." I took this to heart, having read once that all of our desires were given by God, to which end and to whose purpose I did not bother to know. The ceremony ended with a campfire. I found my friends and hugged them one by one, a delight I was just experiencing for the first time welling in my heart. I cried and looked at the stars, resolving to believe, reframing my brain to believe. Rebecca Solnit wrote in her 2004 book, Hope in the Dark, that hope should shove you out the door. The same logic echoes throughout a verse from the book of James, "Faith without works is dead." Since joining the youth camp, my newfound faith propelled me to do work I did not imagine I could do. It extended beyond the camp experience itself since I, as well as my friends, became a youth leader. I stood in front of young kids during other youth camps to tell the story of my faith, advocating for the salvation that Jesus bestowed to the world. How this once-forsaken stranger from Bethlehem bridged the divide between humanity and God. I continued attending worships and participating in youth gatherings even when I got to college. I became a part of a documentation and productions committee, which spurred my love for events production and visual arts. I wasn't just a person with a family and a God to serve. I had purpose. And that's why I eventually quit the group. I didn't have faith in the God we were serving, but the feeling of faith itself, standing with thousands of other young people from all over the world in a crowded sports stadium singing Adonai, lifting our voices and praises, not feeling alone for maybe the first time ever, the communal glee and euphoria, belonging. 4 years after my initial entry into the community, I was starting to see cracks in my belief system. I wasn't sure about certain ideologies the community upheld, like that love should wait. Whenever I had feelings for someone, I would pray and whisper, "Real love waits." But I was a teenager with a propensity for romantic affections, and I felt robbed of the raw experience of crushing at someone so hard. Being a part of something greater renders you small. Being rendered small by a big brand of faith and a community of various personalities while you're still an impressionable, young, growing person in the world can be dangerous. My faith was so misguided that it took me a while to question the patriarchal structures of religion-based youth communities. The kind of faith I had been cultivating required no answers. Since joining the camp, I believed that it was the only path to becoming a holistic and productive person in society. But in the light of that path, other avenues opened up to me too. I saw that Catholicism is not the only avenue that might connect me with something greater. I saw that there's more than one answer. I'm 21 years old now, and it's hard to break some habits I learned from my youth group. I still have trouble working with people who do not make me feel respected at the onset, the same way my youth group did. I still gild my mind with rationalities, build a wall, so that any suggestion of a more freedom-giving faith can be deflected. I still carry the inklings of the ideology passed on to my young, impressionable mind that love, real love, should be unconditional, no holds barred, ready and waiting for me at the door. Otherwise, I should not bother. But I'm trying to unlearn. That's why I'm writing this. I don't want to cordon off that section of my life and declare it lamentable because it also blessed me with authentic friendships and moments with other people. It was through that community that I realized my love for visual arts and events production. So instead of wearing a sackcloth and weeping over some missed and vital stage of my youth, I want to simultaneously glean wisdom from my experiences and go out in the world, relearning and reliving. This, right now, feels like shedding a skin. I still want to have faith, but I want to be faithful to myself first. If I want hope or some other force to shove me out the door, then it should come from my head and heart, and not from external pressures. I want to be rooted in myself, she who I'd never known before. Okay, and this next one is also from Rookie Magazine by Kiana Flores, and it's about college. This one's called Graduating in Good Time. The goal was always to acquire education. I grew up in a household composed of titos, titas, uncles, and grandparents whose education have been impeded by war, poverty, or their own parents' indifference. It was a household that valued full gold achievement medals at the end of every school year. I navigated a childhood that spun around the iteration that only education could get us through poverty, that the lack of education makes one ignorant, a person to be laughed at. My small provincial town not only instilled that idea in me and my peers, but also showed it to us IRL. Middle-class families would spend a lot of money for impressive banquets after their sons' and daughters' college graduations, and everyone in town was invited. Graduations were always a grandiose celebration. Families and friends boasted of each other's educational successes. Too often the answer to, "How are you?" is, "I have a term paper due tomorrow." But absent from these obsessions were dreams, the seeds that germinated in kids' brains about what they wanted for themselves, for their futures. One time, when I was home for a holiday break, I heard my tita ask her 6-year-old son what he wants to be when he grows up. "A policeman," my cousin answered. "Why? That pays small. Be a doctor instead and get rich," my tita said confidently. Don't get me wrong. I don't intend to present my aunt or this attitude in a bad light. There's just a fraction of disconnect here that makes me question why the yearning to move up the ladder soars higher than wanting a child to think and germinate seed dreams for themselves. Why place the heavy and menacing task of upward mobility on young minds? Why care at all? A few months after my high school graduation, my grandmother and I had the talk. She, along with my grandpa and everyone else in the family, wanted me to take up a Bachelor of Science in Education. I cringed and asked why. She shrugged and told me that teachers receive a high salary and a great number of benefits, plus it's a high-demand career. Thankfully, I knew enough to not succumb to the familial pressure of choosing a good job that I didn't want, so I put my foot down. I told her that I planned to go to a liberal arts university to study mass communications. I did not want to waste 4 years living up to everyone else's plans for me. It was difficult, and it took some privilege to shun what my family intended for me to do. I know that not everyone gets to say no, or even choose. I ended up going to that Catholic liberal arts school. I dropped out after 2 years, not out of ill planning or not liking my major, but because of a lot of big, in my mind, incidents. Boys who I paid attention to, regrettably, were rude just because. The people I hung out with on a regular basis found niche friendships, prompting them to disappear almost immediately after the last bell. A trigonometry class that was heartbreaking for me to attend every other day filled me with trepidation. My professors told me I was one of the smartest. I didn't feel like it, which was comparable to them putting heavy blocks on my shoulders. I felt exposed, my skin thin. I looked around, cared, strained, stressed out a lot. My next big plan, created out of the steel-toed decision to escape the claustrophobic Catholic liberal arts school, was to drop out, reclaim all my school and personal records, and rest. And boy, did I rest. After half a year of staring through windows to catch sunsets mid-glory, following a summer spent reading voraciously and sleeping soundly, I tried looking for a real adult job. I was 18 anyway, and could use some money for more books, maybe a vacation. The real adult job lasted 3 months and emptied me, until an email from Rookie asked me if I wanted to write weekly diaries. The adage that you have to empty your cup so that it may be filled held true. A lot of rolling on the floor, scream crying ensued. But guilt crept in. The aforementioned talk with my grandmother made me feel bad about dropping out. I'd ambitiously taken the reins of my life and then felt like I'd failed ambiguously 2 years in. I was ashamed and thought about what would have happened had I agreed to take up a major in education. Sure, every class would have made me want to gorge my own eyes out, but it was also a path to security and convention, both being structures that a lower middle class family assumes it can build a future with. What the hell was I thinking, taking up humanities and then getting shook all of a sudden by the holographic multidimensionality of life, as discussed in my Philosophy of a Human Person class? What would my grandmother and my high school classmates think? So I forged on and got a scholarship to another Catholic university. I continued studying mass communications, but being a dropout and a transferee delayed my going up the curriculum/year-level ladder. I had to be enrolled as an irregular student with second-year status instead of fourth. And here we are, in the present moment, with me currently taking summer classes to make up for lost time, or lost college credits. My high school classmates, my first friends and first enemies, both can be true at once, love functions both ways, etc., graduated from their respective universities about a month ago, and I'm filled with awe and pride for their hard work and discipline. There are a lot of congratulations and heart emojis of various colors in our correspondences last month. I cried and thought about them and the lives they will foster after graduation. Surely they'd still want to hang out, right? Or maybe not, because now they'd have to find jobs, take board exams, or go on long stretches of vacation. What about me? My emotions were in a disarray. There they were, my high school pals, all robed and capped up for graduation, for real life. While here I am in my new university, full of spite and rancor, running the hallways to meet numerous deadlines, performing second-year English plays at the age of 20. International news. If I had an alter cartoon ego a la Lizzie McGuire, she would mock me, hand propped on her chin, and rolling her eyes like crazy. These feelings of self-inflicted smallness sometimes badger and tug at my softest spots, but I know better than to let them seep through and get the best of me. I also made it a point not to feel bad, singularly, for myself and for what I've decided to do with my life, anchoring it on the calm conviction that the physical world around me is legitimate proof of survival. There are other people like me in this university, or in any university really, who share this experience of dropping out and feeling like they're disappointing everyone. I met a number of irregular students who were also behind on their academics. I even found a few friends because of our shared stories and some wondrous Me Too moments. One told me that since the day they decided to stop caring about year-level status or what they like doing, it was like they built a spacious room for mistakes. This propelled me to return my gaze back to what's important. The reason I enrolled in this university in the first place, after a year of staring at the sky. The dream. No amount of graduation robes flailing about, of graduation caps thrown into the air, or of friends graduating could deter me from that. It may be just a part of the puzzle now, a singular thoroughfare in my goal map, but I'm comforted knowing that I'm heeding the call of what tugs at me. Even when a professor solidifies into a total moron as the semester wears on, even when my groupmates couldn't do their share, even when a Greek play I directed tumbled to failure, even then, I lounge on a cloud and know that this is the path I deliberately chose to follow and create for myself. Sorry, I just lost my place. I deliberately chose to follow and create for myself, not for anyone else. I wouldn't have lived this any other way. What I have now are complimentary little oofs, fellow student kin who teach me that writing an essay due the next day will matter as much, maybe more actually, as the nearest graduation month or day. The frustrating breakthrough of all-nighters, the earnestness in finding and underlining important passages in a book instead of giving up. Graduating is not a race. The nearest graduation date is not a finish line I have to sprint to. It may not look like I have a lot of time left, but time happens all the time. Maybe now every completed semester will feel like a small victory, enjoyed for a good short measure until a new term brings fresh hope for order, good-natured professors, and notebooks not too filled with crushed declarations or odes to propel self-hating. Maybe this is enough reason to throw my non-graduation cap in the air. All right, this next one is from Believer Mag, and it's by Leslie Jameson. And this one is called The Empathy Exams, and the writer is a medical actor writing her own script. My job title is medical actor, which means I play sick. I get paid by the hour. Medical students guess my maladies. I'm called a standardized patient, which means I act toward the norms of my disorders. I'm standardized lingo SP for short. I'm fluent in the symptoms of preeclampsia and asthma and appendicitis. I play a mom whose baby has blue lips. Medical acting works like this. You get a script and a paper gown. You get $13.50 an hour. Our scripts are 10 to 12 pages long. They outline what's wrong with us, not just what hurts, but how to express it. They tell us how much to give away and when. We are supposed to unfurl the answers according to specific protocols. The scripts dig deep into our fictive lives, the ages of our children and the diseases of our parents, the names of our husbands' real estate and graphic design firms, the amount of weight we've lost in the past year, the amount of alcohol we drink each week. My specialty case is Stephanie Phillips, a 23-year-old who suffers from something called conversion disorder. She is grieving the death of her brother, and her grief has sublimated into seizures. Her disorder is news to me. I didn't know you could have a seizure from sadness. She's not supposed to know either. She's not supposed to think the seizures have anything to do with what she's lost. Stephanie Phillips, Psychiatry, SP Training Materials. Case summary. You are a 23-year-old female patient experiencing seizures with no identifiable neurological origin. You can't remember your seizures, but are told you froth at the mouth and yell obscenities. You can usually feel a seizure coming before it arrives. The seizures began 2 years ago, shortly after your older brother drowned in the river just south of the Bennington Avenue Bridge. He was swimming drunk after a football tailgate. You and he worked at the same mini golf course. These days, you don't work at all. These days you don't do much. You're afraid of having a seizure in public. No doctor has been able to help you. Your brother's name was Will. Medication history. You are not taking any medications. You've never taken antidepressants. You've never thought you needed them. Medical history. Your health has never caused you any trouble. You've never had anything worse than a broken arm. Will was there when it was broken. He was the one who called for the paramedics and kept you calm until they came. Our simulated exams take place in three suites of purpose-built rooms. Each room is fitted with an examination table and a surveillance camera. We test second and third year medical students in topical rotations, pediatrics, surgery, psychiatry. On any given day of exams, each student must go through encounters, their technical title, with three or four actors playing different cases. A student might have to palpate a woman's 10 on a scale of 10 pain in her lower abdomen, then sit across from a delusional young lawyer and tell him that when he feels a writhing mass of worms in his small intestine, the feeling is probably coming from somewhere else. Then this med student might arrive in my room, stay straight-faced, and tell me that I might go into premature labor to deliver the pillow strapped to my belly, or nod solemnly as I express concern about my ailing plastic baby. He's just so quiet! Once the 15-minute encounter has finished, the medical student leaves the room, and I fill out an evaluation of his or her performance. The first part is a checklist. Which crucial pieces of information did he or she manage to elicit? Which ones did he or she leave uncovered? The second part of the evaluation covers affect. Checklist item 31 is generally acknowledged as the most important category, voiced empathy for my situation or problem. We are instructed about the importance of this first word, voiced. It's not enough for someone to have a sympathetic manner or use a caring tone of voice. The students have to say the right words to get credit for compassion. We SPs are given our own suite for preparation and decompression. We gather in clusters, old men in crinkling blue robes, MFA graduates in boots too cool for our paper gowns, local teenagers in ponchos and sweatpants. We help each other strap pillows around our waists. We hand off infant dolls, little pneumatic baby Doug, swaddled in a cheap cotton blanket, is passed from girl to girl like a relay baton. Our ranks are full of community theater actors and undergrad drama majors seeking stages, high school kids earning booze money, retired folks with spare time. I am a writer, which is to say, I'm trying not to be broke. We play a demographic menagerie. Young jocks with ACL injuries and business executives nursing coke habits. STD grandma has just cheated on her husband of 40 years and has an STD to show for it. She hides behind her shame like a veil, and her med student is supposed to part the curtain. If he's asking the right questions, she'll have a simulated crying breakdown halfway through the encounter. Blackout buddy gets makeup, a gash on his chin, a black eye, and bruises smudged in green eyeshadow along his cheekbone. He's been in a minor car crash he can't remember. Before the encounter, the actor splashes booze on his body like cologne. He's supposed to let the particulars of his alcoholism glimmer through, very unplanned, bits of a secret he's done his best to keep guarded. Our scripts are studded with moments of flourish. Pregnant Lila's husband is a yacht captain sailing overseas in Croatia. Appendicitis Angela has a dead guitarist uncle whose tour bus was hit by a tornado. Many of our extended family members have died violent Midwestern deaths, mauled in tractor or grain elevator accidents, hit by drunk drivers on the way home from Hy-Vee grocery stores, felled by a Big Ten tailgate, or, like my brother Will, by the aftermath of its debauchery. Between encounters, we are given water, fruit, granola bars, and an endless supply of mints. We aren't supposed to exhaust the students with our bad breath and growling stomachs, the side effects of our actual bodies. Some med students get nervous during our encounters. It's like an awkward date, except half of them are wearing platinum wedding bands. I want to tell them I'm more than just an unmarried woman faking seizures for pocket money. I do things, I want to tell them. I'm probably going to write about this in a book someday. We make small talk about the rural Iowa farm town I'm supposed to be from. We each understand the other is inventing this small talk, and we agree to respond to each other's inventions as genuine exposures of personality. We're holding the fiction between us like a jump rope. One time, a student forgets we are pretending and starts asking detailed questions about my fake hometown, which, as it happens, if he's being honest, is his real hometown. And his questions lie beyond the purview of my script, beyond what I can answer, because in truth I don't know much about the person I'm supposed to be or the place I'm supposed to be from. He's forgotten our contract. I lie harder, more heartily. That park in Muscatine, I say, slapping my knee like a grandpa. I used to sled there as a kid. Other students are all business. They rattle through the clinical checklist for depression like a list of things they need to get at the grocery store. Sleep disturbances, changes in appetite, decreased concentration. Some of them get irritated when I obey my script and refuse to make eye contact. I'm supposed to stay swaddled and numb. These irritated students take my averted eyes as a challenge. They never stop seeking my gaze. Wrestling me into eye contact is the way they maintain power, forcing me to acknowledge their requisite display of care. I grow accustomed to comments that feel aggressive in their formulaic insistence. That must really be hard to have a dying baby. That must really be hard to be afraid you'll have another seizure in the middle of the grocery store. That must really be hard to carry in your uterus the bacterial evidence of cheating on your husband. Why not say, I couldn't even imagine? Other students seem to understand that empathy is always perched precariously between gift and invasion. They won't even press the stethoscope to my skin without asking if it's okay. They need permission. They don't want to presume. Their stuttering unwittingly honors my privacy. Would you mind if I listen to your heart? No, I tell them. I don't mind. Not minding is my job. Their humility is a kind of compassion in its own right. Humility means they ask questions, and questions mean they get answers, and answers mean they get points on the checklist, a point for finding out my mother takes Wellbutrin, a point for getting me to admit I've spent the last 2 years cutting myself, a point for finding out my father died in a grain elevator when I was 2, for realizing that a root system of loss stretches radial and rhizomatic under the entire territory of my life. In this sense, empathy isn't measured just by checklist item 31, voiced empathy for my situation slash problem, but by every item that gauges how thoroughly my experience has been imagined. Empathy isn't just remembering to say, that must really be hard. It's figuring out how to bring difficulty into the light so it can be seen at all. Empathy isn't just listening. It's asking the questions whose answers need to be listened to. Empathy requires inquiry as much as imagination. Empathy requires knowing you know nothing. Empathy means acknowledging a horizon of context that extends perpetually beyond what you can see. An old woman's gonorrhea is connected to her guilt, is connected to her marriage, is connected to her children, is connected to the days when she was a child. Empathy means realizing no trauma has discrete edges. Trauma bleeds out of wounds and across boundaries. Sadness becomes a seizure. Empathy demands another kind of porousness in response. My Stephanie script is 12 pages long. I think mainly about what it doesn't say. That article was edited for time because we've run out of time for today's episode of Teen Magazines. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Romani Arrowsmith, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comment or questions, please call 919-832-5138.